This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick. Super Bowl Sunday is that most American of secular holidays, a mass public worship of the sports and entertainment juggernaut that is the National Football League. So as people are gearing up for Sunday's big game with the Los Angeles Rams and the Cincinnati Bengals, some of the league's unsavory traits are unfortunately surfacing, at least for the league, particularly its treatment of black coaches, how it addresses health issues, and its tolerance of hostile work environments, one right here in the nation's capital, for instance, and other issues such as violence on and off the field and just, you know, the overall issues that come with such a big enterprise as the NFL. With us on Political Theater to discuss these political footballs is Jane Costin, host of the New York Times podcast, The Argument, and an opinions writer at The Times. Jane, welcome to Political Theater.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are, you know, as I mentioned, we're all sort of getting our orders for barbecue and wings and chips and so forth for Sunday. This will be the NFL's first Super Bowl at the LA Chargers and LA Rams' new home in Inglewood, California, which is just this massive, you know, $5 billion high-tech stadium. I mean, this is, you know, the NFL is riding high. You know, it's got record popularity. It had an incredibly entertaining regular season, the first one to go 17 games. You know, it's truly like a part of the fabric of our country. And then it just has these really gnarly things, bad things going on, you know, at an operational level. Before we get to some of that, though, I've got to ask one of the most recent changes, a cosmetic change, if you will, at the Washington football team was the team recently, which was nameless for 2 years after having another nickname, which will go unsaid on this podcast, unveiled their new name, the Commanders. And I'm curious how you feel about the name change, being a football fan yourself.
I feel as if it's interesting to me that there were so many options that were interesting, but we knew that they would not choose one of the interesting ones. There were some people who were like, well, you could be the Red Tails, kind of in honor of African Americans who fought in the Second World War, or any host of interesting names tied to DC or tied to the team's legacy in a good way. And then I looked at who leads this team and I thought, no, that's not what it's going to be. It's going to be something anodyne. Like the Commanders is fine. It's just also funny because it's going to be the kind of name that you just kind of forget is there. It's the name that they picked. It is the one that has been beaten to death in focus groups for long enough that I'm like, of course, I'm sure, obviously.
Let's talk about, this has been a heady week already. It's you know, as we're recording this, I mean, we've got the Super Bowl coming up on Sunday. But today, you know, in the last few 24 hours or so, the NFL, you know, had this huge coaching vacancy carousel at the end of the regular season. And then all of a sudden, you know, in the middle of a debate about black coaches, black head coaches, and the lack of opportunity being afforded to them, even though some of them have absolutely sterling credentials for it, all the vacancies are filled. The number of black coaches has gone up 100%. So there are now two of them,
right,
in the league. When Lovie Smith was hired by the Houston Texans, let's talk about where we are and like why this is so significant. Why it is such an important thing to kind of get right and to reflect on as a business and as a political system, as a culture.
I was joking last night with a friend that when the Texans said it was between Josh McCown and Brian Flores, I just imagined some attorney running in out of nowhere being like, no, there is another. And just saying like, yeah, Lovie Smith is qualified to do this job. He's been the assistant head coach. But the fact that this, it came to this moment, it came to Josh McCown, who's never coached at any level and was as recently as October being an available veteran quarterback who would be nice to add to a locker room, for him to have gotten not just, he was offered the assistant coach position last year. He had two interviews this year. Like, at a certain point, it seemed to make Flores's point for him. And when I spoke to him, he talked about how he was still up for that job. He interviewed well for that job. And I think that the entire thing just goes to show how I don't think that this was the work of some sort of snidely whiplash, evil Mississippi burning racist within the ownership core of the NFL. I do think that the ownership core of the NFL is prone to the same types of groupthink that we see in large organizations of any kind, in which they are aware that, you know, there are coaches that you give a long runway to, and there are coaches who you give them a shot, even though you shouldn't. Like, I just kept, you know, you kept seeing how Josh McDaniel got another job or something like that, which I was like, you know, I was alive for his tenure at the Broncos. It did not go well. But you see someone like Vance Joseph who doesn't get another chance. And for Lovey
and,
to
and
get,
some people who get no chance at all, like Eric Bieniemy and Byron Leftwich.
Who Eric Bieniemy, who I think at this point has interviewed with half the teams in the league over the last 3 years. And I believe it was Andy Reid who was saying, like, I kind of wish he weren't here anymore. Like, I can't believe he doesn't have a head coaching job yet. And I think that it is interesting to me that this is posited as being like, oh, like, you know, this is a meritocracy or something. When Josh McCown was floated numerous times for a job, we knew that wasn't true. And we've known that isn't true. We know that this becomes about, like, you know, a vibes check for NFL owners, where it's like, well, did he work with this guy who I respect? You know, we've seen that with the so-called Bill Belichick coaching tree, which is like a stump. You see it with what happened with Detroit, with bringing in Matt Patricia, who was a worse coach, who did not have the experience and who was just a worse coach than the coach that they fired to get him. NFL teams do not work like, they are companies, but they don't work like companies. Right. Like, you know, I'm from Cincinnati. Any company that ran like how Mike Brown ran the Bengals and has run the Bengals since 1988 would not be, he would no longer be a CEO, but these are owners. They are not CEOs exactly. And so I think that this really goes to just seeing like the fallibility of the NFL ownership core. We've seen that with the Jaguars, with hiring Urban Meyer because vibes. We've seen that with a host of other coaching efforts that seem to ignore the people who are the most experienced. And especially, I think the point that some have made is that part of this will be, you know, you hear from NFL writers saying that, like, well, you know, they're looking for, they want to hire an offensive coordinator, and there aren't enough Black offensive coordinators, which one, like, that's not a reason to not hire a Black head coach. But also, we see that when Black coaches get started out, they get shunted into into run game, into, you know, coordinators, into specific aspects of the game that then are not chosen to be head coaches. And then sometimes you're Josh McCown and some guy decides maybe he should be the head coach of an NFL team because he seems nice. And it just is like, this is not about, it's not even about corporate culture. And, you know, we'll talk about with the Commanders. This is about ownership. This is about if you ran, you know, I've never watched Succession, but I believe it is a show about people being idiots while running a company that is owned by the people who are idiots. And yeah, that sounds like an NFL team. That sounds like an NFL. It's not about profit margins, because the NFL, as we've learned, the NFL can fall down the stairs and make $1 billion doing it.
Yeah, every week, it seems.
Every week, and it's on the field, it's off the field. It's with refereeing decisions that don't make any sense that they, you know, you hear back later from the NFL being like, oh yeah, we should have called that, but we didn't, like, and no one, and it has no impact. And it's fascinating to see the league as this Teflon entity when other sports leagues are not. Major League Baseball, I mean, granted, Major League Baseball has the worst owner in sports, and that's saying something because there are very few good chairs of sports leagues. They don't really exist. But Major League Baseball has its own issues with that. But like, it is interesting to me that this is one of those challenges, and that's why I think that Flores' lawsuit is so interesting, is that like, the NFL could do what it's probably going to do, which is they released a memo saying that they were going to reevaluate its diversity practices.
Maybe and they'll I'm form sure a subcommittee.
Ooh, they're going to form, yeah. And then eventually we'll get somewhere. Let's keep in mind the Rooney Rule was created because of a study that was announced then at a press conference by the late Johnny Cochran, who threatened to sue. And the response was the owners were like, what is the easiest possible option for us? And the Rooney Rule was the easiest possible option. And the owners agreed to it unanimously because, again, it was easy. It's very easy to say like, yeah, we'll interview at least one minority coach for all head coaching openings. And that has expanded to general managers as well. Yeah, but then it turns out that you can do that without meaning it. And you know, that's what happens when you give lip service to this idea.
And that's kind of the crux of Flores. And again, for those of our listeners who are perhaps not as nerding out on football as Jane and I right now, Brian Flores was the head coach of the Miami Dolphins for the past 3 years. He was fired after two consecutive winning seasons. He has filed a lawsuit alleging that the league is discriminating particularly against him and black coaches. And part of that was spurred by the feeling that he got and some anecdotal evidence that some of the interviews that he was, some of the jobs he was interviewing for were just sham interviews, that they were just simply, you know, pro formas, as you mentioned.
Right. I think that's a concerning thing. And part of Flores' lawsuit is that when he had not yet interviewed for the New York Giants open position, the New York Giants noted shambolic organization. and he got a text message from Bill Belichick being like, oh, Brian, congrats. You know, I heard that it's going to be you. And he had to...
The wrong Brian.
Yeah. And I just keep thinking, I had a text message back and forth with my friend Clinton Yates, where I was just like, I cannot imagine how painful it is to be like, which Brian are you sending this to? And to know like, oh, I didn't get the job that I have not yet interviewed for. Like this is, you know, if, and this is something that he talked about having experiences with something similar happened with the Broncos in 2019. And I think that there are, it's a really heartbreaking element of this. When I spoke with him, it was just striking how much, one, he really wants to coach. He really, really wants to coach.
And he's a good one, too.
He's a good coach. I mean, if you saw what, and you know, that's what you see time and time again, is that he got something out of nothing with the Dolphins, which is part of why he alleges that part of why he was fired is because he won too many games and hurt their draft position. But we saw that with the Texans as well, like that you have a coach who overperforms. And it's funny talking about this with the Texans because they finished 4-13 with David Culley. But for the Texans, who were intentionally basically tanking because they've sold off everybody, you know, JJ's gone, like they've sold off all their best players. 4-13 is like this tremendous achievement. And I think that, you know, and then you see that he's fired after working in the league for nearly three decades and being, you know, an assistant coach in Tampa Bay, Philadelphia, Baltimore. And then it's, you know, I cannot imagine being David Culley and then hearing that Josh McCown got interviews and that the Texans were so enthusiastic about hiring him before, I assume, a lawyer walked in and was like, absolutely not, we cannot do this, that they were trying to get other teams to interview him and talk about it so there would be a legitimate choice. And that's what we were hearing from the sports writer, Mike Florio. And it just is, I told somebody that like, if Josh McCown got the head coaching job of the Texans, like Flores' lawsuit, just basically, I'm like, well, that's it. That's the whole, like I just, the lawsuit could have just said Josh McCown. That's all you needed to say.
Yeah, I'm really curious where the lawsuit goes because I do feel like the where this gets really important, I think, to note, because some people are not everybody is a football fan, but where it gets important is that just how much influence football has, in entertainment, and in sports. I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. All you have to do is look at who is advertising on the Super Bowl on Sunday to see what the big movers and shakers in the economy are, who has disposable income as companies and want to push that message to the widest possible audience. And how the NFL reacts, whether they try to settle this, whether they fight it, whether they fight Flores in court, is just going to be, I think it's going to be a very important moment for us. Because I honestly, when I read your column and your interview with Flores, and I just thought, oh God, this guy's going to get Kaepernicked, isn't he? I mean, he's never going to work in the NFL again, because he's brave enough, to take a stand like Colin Kaepernick, and then the result is, in the prime of his career, he will not get another job.
And that's, I think that's part of this, because the idea that what we have currently is a meritocracy, and that what Flores and others want is some sort of affirmative action. It's just like, have you seen the NFL? Do you know how many trash coaches there are in the NFL? There are coaches who, if you give them 2 minutes and unlimited timeouts and 30 yards, they would wind into a ditch. And we know that. We've seen it all the time. Like, there are very bad coaches in the NFL. There are very bad coaches with pretty okay teams, because at a certain point, there are sometimes where the talent level evens out. But when it comes to decision-making, when it comes to late game scenarios, when it comes to, do you kick here? Do you not kick here? When to punt, when not to punt? There are certain coaches where their instincts are always wrong. And I think that there's a real sense here that this is not about that these coaches aren't good enough to do this. They are not being chosen, and they are not able to show what they can do.
Let's segue to the, I'm just saying Washington football team, because I think Commanders is just, it's just not penetrating my psyche. But the Washington's franchise, once proud, three Super Bowl championships, mm-hmm. Had a real, sort of time, in Washington, particularly in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, was just a really special time to be, a Washington fan. Dan Snyder, the current owner, has kind of taken it in a different direction. Is that the most diplomatic way to say that?
Yes.
And more than just his inability to consistently win or sign people who are not at the tail end of a career or never had a career but he actually has attracted not just the attention of people who are paying attention to football with a hostile work environment, but the attention of Congress even, which again is not, they're preoccupied, funding the government and worrying about Russia and all this kind of stuff. And they are actually, the House Oversight, committee is investigating the team's, whether they harassed, serial harassment of women who worked for the organization. And I mean, this to me is like an elevated, even beyond just the fact that it's here and this is a major media market and a lot mm-hmm. of people pay attention to this because of the glare of Washington. To me, this seems like this is a really big deal.
Oh, yeah. I think the issue that Washington has here, it's funny to talk about this because it's like, I'm going to wind up saying Washington and Washington in numerous ways, so I should probably be more specific. The issue that the Washington Commanders have is that literally everything they have done is wrong. Everything. So with regard to, if folks recall that there was a investigation into the practices of the Commanders with regard to sexual harassment, which was endemic within the organization. And there was a investigation by Beth Wilkinson's law firm. There was a written investigation, and then there was a oral presentation. And currently, the NFL is not able to publicly release the findings of those investigations without the explicit permission of Daniel Snyder.
Right.
One of...
interested party, you might call him.
Right? Yes, a mildly interested party in that, you know, many... There's an entire separate set of allegations against him for just...
Being
a big old creep. And yep. So...
videotaping his cheerleaders naked, yes, coming on, yes, to them, harassing them.
Yeah, demanding, you know, secret tapes of cheerleaders in various states of undress, soundtracked by his favorite music. He had investigators sent to the homes of former cheerleaders. He... someone said told the House Oversight Committee that Daniel Snyder should not be managing any human beings, which I think anyone who has been so unlucky as to watch Washington football play for the last decade would be like, yeah, this all checks out. This 100% checks out. And it is interesting to me that initially he handled this by handing over the team to his wife to become CEO. Yeah, which I'm just like, oh, don't worry, I'm not involved because my wife Tanya is taking over as CEO. And I feel as if I'm reminded of about a decade ago, there was a Washington City paper guide to Daniel Snyder. And it resulted in Daniel Snyder... clearly not understanding what the Streisand effect is. They first wanted the person who wrote it fired and then sued, which obviously then led to more...
unflattering stories about what
right,
a bully
and
he
it just
is.
Yeah. This is not... this has been going on for more than a decade. This is someone who... this is going on for multiple decades. This is someone who was charging money to go to workouts. They're charging fans for admission to the team's workouts in the year 2000. This is someone who would charge money to basically anyone doing anything regarding the time or regarding the team. And I think that I found that article, and there was a quote in it from the then director of economic policy studies, AEI, Kevin Hassett, who said that Snyder's football operation was a leading exemplar of this tendency towards irrationality. Like, he is not good at this. He's not good at this. He is not a good person, and he's not good at his job. But because of how the NFL works, you cannot extricate without a great deal of difficulty, and Lord knows people are trying, you cannot extricate a team from the people who own it. It is a... giant expensive problem. And it's a giant expensive problem that is the fault of Dan Snyder and it is the fault of the people who work around Dan Snyder. And I think that we see time and time again that this type of behavior will be handled the way the NFL handles everything, which will be that they'll get back to you or there'll be a memo or there'll be a committee. Because inaction is far easier than action. Yeah. Of any type. And I think that that's something, it's particularly telling with the Washington example.
And I think, one of the things that, one of the sticks, if you will, that Congress, or at least the administration and working with Congress have against the Snyder and the Washington team is that they can subpoena documents. They may not get them, but then there's also the case of he wants to move from suburban Maryland, Prince George's County, back into D.C.
Right.
And pretty much anywhere he wants to put a stadium in D.C. needs some sort of federal sign off.
Right.
Because the land is owned typically by the Interior Department or something like that. So there is this push-pull in D.C. that doesn't really exist necessarily in a lot of other cities where, the billionaire says, I want a multi-billion dollar stadium right here.
Right.
And I'm just going to wipe out a city block.
Which I do kind of appreciate that this can't be done the way Paul Brown Stadium was, which would just be the taxpayers will pay for it and we're going to charge the hell out of them.
Yep.
I think a lot about how It would be extremely expensive because if you haven't been to RFK in a long time, it's more shambolic than you think it might be. But it is like an incredibly logical place for a stadium to be. It is like at the end of an intersection. Like you can see the Capitol from RFK. It's just at the end of the same very long street. And
it's in a straight line with the monument too.
Yeah, and
Roslyn. I mean, it's a gorgeous sight line.
It's a great sight line. It's a great location. It would be, if it worked, it would be a great idea. And it doesn't work because, and it's been interesting because the mayor is always like, when they announced the name change, the mayor was like, well, you know, what would be really cool is if we could get them moved back into the city, because currently to go to a Washington Commanders game from DC without a car involves the metro and then a mile and a half walk, which lovely walk, but like still probably not exactly what everyone's hoping for.
Yeah. And RFK is right there on the subway. So
it's right there. It's at Stadium Armory, the metro stop. So I think it's all a mess. It's a giant mess. And but that's the thing about the NFL is that you can have a long running giant mess and everyone still makes a lot of money. Like if I remember correctly, like the Washington football team is one of the most profitable football team, like one of the most profitable football teams. It's the 11th richest team in the NFL. The Cowboys are number one because they can sell merchandise and they're the richest sports team in the world, which is an amusing thought in many ways. But like, there are diehard Washington football team fans, diehard Commanders fans, and a lot of them live in DC and have been fans of the team for their entire lives. And I just keep thinking about how like, if you're a fan of this team, a team that has made it harder and harder. I mean, I feel very much, I remember there was a time when Matt Millen owned the Detroit Lions and things got so bad that people went on strike. Like there was a march around the stadium with like hundreds of people demanding his firing and demanding he get out. And I will say, to the credit of the Ford family, they were like, okay, okay.
Yeah, with all this, I mean, like, there are so many problems. And, we could talk about some of the other issues, you know, whether, like, how they kind of cover up domestic violence and, you know, among the players, and they just sort of shunt off people on, you know, like Antonio Brown, who's obviously needs counseling, you know, and things like that. Why does it have this hold on us? Why do we all love football so much? Because I find myself, despite all that, still wanting to watch the games, I feel bad about it, kind of, but I also like it's hugely entertaining, and it just has this pull on us, and I can't figure out why.
I think that football is the most beautiful sport in the world. I've loved football since I was a kid. I used to watch with my dad, to hang out with my dad, because my dad, he watched the Bengals every Sunday, which
God help him. I was
in the early 90s. It was just like, man. Like the idea of the bank, like that's why I think I'm finding this Super Bowl so like mind shattering. It's just like I was born in 1987, so I have no memory of the most recent Super Bowl. I have no memory of the most recent before this year playoff win. My entire life has been the Bengals being awful.
The Bungles. They were the Cincinnati Bungles.
And that's, I feel as if it's like my brain can't entirely comprehend it. Where it just is like, it's like if you, it's like a real Back to the Future moment where you're just like, wait, who, Biff's in charge now? What? Like, and I just keep being like kind of overwhelmed by it. But I really do think that it's the most beautiful sport. It is, it's visually interesting. Mm-hmm. Just the combination of the brutality and the artistry and the strategy, where it's like playing hundreds of games of chess. Every single down is a chess game. What are you going to do? What are you going to do as a result of what the other person does? And to see this happening with some of the best athletes in the world, doing something that is incredibly specific. It is not a sport that can compare to other sports. If you're an offensive lineman, you're an offensive lineman, and you are built to do that thing. And yet you also get people who are like wide receivers, where you kind of have the feeling like you could have done literally anything, but this is what you do and you're the best in the world at it. And I just think that there is something about that, especially when you see the full field and you see the ball snap and you just keep thinking like, what's happening? And it's like somehow your eye, it's one of the few times in which my eyes can go two directions at once. And I'm like, top of the field, bottom of the field, who's open, what's going on, what's the blitz packaging, who's where, who, what's going on. And it's absorbing. I always think it's funny that like watching college football, I will forget what time it is. I will forget to eat. I will forget to do anything. I'll be like, oh, I haven't had any water today because see, I've been watching 8 hours of football. And it just is like, it is somehow in a time where attention grabbing is harder than ever. Football is fully attention possessing. I mean, the NFL is the most infuriating league in the world because they are managing the most beautiful sport in the world. And they know that they could, there are very few things they could do that would truly turn people off for a long period of time. And for example, a lot of the things people get really mad about, it turns out pay dividends later. Like protecting the quarterback, those efforts that started, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, are why you can have somebody like a Patrick Mahomes or something like that. You can have quarterbacks with more mobility because you're aware that if they get out of the pocket, they're not going to get immediately just blindsided by somebody. So even when people complained about, oh, that's ruining the game, like now the game is even faster than before. Everybody scores all the time. And like people like watching that. It just is, it's infuriating because it's like, if you knew this really wonderful person who just kept falling over all the time, and you're like, if you just would stop doing that, it's, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard out here.
Well, it's going to keep our attention at least, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I, like I said, I really appreciate you like talking about all these issues and how they interrelate, because it is hard to kind of grasp how big it is just in our consciousness as well as our pocketbooks and in our culture. So, Jane, where can people follow you on social media, on Twitter and so forth?
I'm at Jane Costin on Twitter. And you can, as always, listen to my podcast, The Argument, or read my newsletter in the New York Times.
For sure, yes. Please subscribe to Jane's podcast. It is awesome. It's a good listen. And as you can hear, she's awesome. Jane, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much.